Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to a very special prehistoric spoiler special for Jurassic World. Yes, that's right. Colin Trevorrow's follow-up to Steven Spielberg's classic original dinosaur flick. There were two in between, but we don't like to talk about those. 14 years after Jurassic Park 3, and here to discuss the movie with me in glorious, spoiler-filled, third-act ruining detail are... Helen O'Hara, how
Hello.
Are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm also joined by Phil Desemlian. How are you, Phil?
Very good, thank you, Chris.
And last but not least, we are joined by not just Empire's resident Jurassic Park expert, but one of the stars of Jurassic World, as Edmund, the indelible character Edmund.
Don't look me in the eye. You've been over this before the podcast.
You blink and you'll miss him. Is it one shot you're in? It's Nick Desemlian. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello,
everybody.
This is the first time we've had a spoiler podcast with the team where the talent has been involved. It's amazing.
The emphasis heavily on talent. I've seen the film twice now. I'm pretty sure I'm not in it.
Colin Trevorrow says you are.
He claims I am.
He claims you are.
But... Okay. There's no evidence on screen.
So far, it's happening,
but I'm going to keep going back.
Well, we got the
laser
room.
Pen until this matter is cleared up. But
just to clear things up, we think you're in the early sequence with the mosasaur.
Yeah, it's when the people get splashed, and we were hosed down with freezing cold water for about 10 minutes.
Okay,
so I'd like to be in the film after that.
Okay, before we get into it, if you haven't seen Jurassic World, then do stop listening to this, go and see the film, go to the cinema and see it, and then come back and start listening to it, because we're going to get into it in great detail. And we also got into it in great detail with the film's director and co-writer, Colin Trevorrow. When he came at the pod booth recently, he gave us a lot of his time and discussed a lot of the film's key incidents and key moments. And he was talking to Phil and Nick, and here it is.
We are thrilled and delighted to be joined by the director of Safety Not Guaranteed and, of course, now Jurassic World, Colin Trevorrow, on the Empire podcast. Spoiler special, Jurassic World spoiler special. Colin, thank you very much for coming in.
A pretty, pretty impressive and awesome Empire cover for this movie.
We had a lot of readers putting their pets behind the behind the kind of slashed cover.
Yes, anything that becomes meme-worthy instantly is good by me.
Speaking of meme-worthy, I wondered, you tweeted a while back a picture of a Jeff Goldblum standee that was adorning your production office on this movie. Who got to keep that? I take it you're not traveling the world with it.
It's still in the building. I actually see it through a window where we cut the movie. Is the same building that we were in pre-production, and somebody managed to get it and put it in their office. So I'll pass by. It's probably some other show. It's like, you know, Scandal or something, and I'll just pass by, and they've got the Jeff Goldblum in there. So he lives.
You just pass it from production to production, like
right.
Some sort of cool heirloom.
I don't think anyone could. That will never go in the trash. Like, no one could ever let that. You know, let that go. There'll always be somebody who wants, open-shirted Jeff Goldblum.
I think it's illegal to throw that away. Yeah. For starters.
Talking of Jeff, rather Ian Malcolm, he appears in the movie in a form.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate? Because I didn't spot this, but he's on a book cover.
Yeah, he's on a book cover very early in the film as they're on the monorail headed into Jurassic World. And, you know, your eyes are always focused on something else. And those are my favorite kinds of ways to bury things when it's like, you know, the third time you see it. But Zara, who is hopefully a character that will grow to, I guess, now that we know she's, you know, horrifically torn apart, is a character we'll all grow to love. But she is reading his book on the way. And then also Lowry has it on his desk.
Right.
So you see it at certain points. God created dinosaurs.
Amazing.
I was a little traumatized by Zara's ending in
sure.
this movie. I guess that's the point.
Well, yeah, it's a terror, it's a horror film.
I mean, what a way to go.
Yeah.
It's the way I want to go.
Well, you know, it was funny. We had, we knew that it was the first time that a woman was going to die in a Jurassic Park movie. That had never happened before.
Oh,
and we feel like, you know, we're an equal opportunity bunch of murderers on this movie, and so we felt like, all right, if we're going to do it, you know, let's make it the most spectacular death that we could possibly imagine, and involve, you know, multiple animals from, you know, sea and air, and we certainly did. And you know, I love that moment so much. It really is it is a moment that just articulates very clearly, you know, the kind of action and surprise that I love and tried to do with this movie as much as possible, which is, you know, playing on the audience's expectation and jadedness even to storytelling. And you drop her in the water and immediately everybody says, oh, I know what's going to happen. But you don't. And then the birds start coming in, and then you get distracted by that, and then suddenly what you thought was going to happen happens. And I love just trusting that you know everyone in the crowd is certainly going to be thinking about it the same way that I am. But it's the part of the film that hopefully you kind of shed that a little bit and start allowing yourself to watch it the way you do when you're a kid, which is you don't think about how they made it or what they're going to do next, how they're going to manipulate me, which is my ultimate goal, is to not necessarily set your brain free. It's not a mindless movie, but watch it like an 8-year-old.
Had to be the British character, though, didn't it? Had to be the bitchy British nanny.
I knew I'd be accused of that somewhere. Well, she's Irish, okay. So she had no problem with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we definitely struggled with how much to allow her to earn her death. Mm. And ultimately, it wasn't because she was British. It was because she was a bridezilla. That's what we settled on. And we gave her, you know, she has one line where she's saying, the bachelor party, because all his friends are animals. And but in the end, you know, I feel that, you know, the earned death in these movies is something that's become a bit standard. And another thing that I wanted to subvert and, you know, how can we surprise people? Well, let's have somebody die that just doesn't deserve to die at all. Mm. It happens in horror films all the time. And it shocks me at times, and I know it's coming.
I mean, have you guys totted up the body count of this film? Because it has the biggest body count of the Jurassic Park films.
I think it has a bigger body count than the others combined.
It gets crazy.
Yeah. And that wasn't our intention. It's just that, you know, the scale of action and the amount of carnage, the minute that you let a bunch of pteranodons and dimorphodons out and they're attacking a crowd of people, we actually don't know what the body count is.
I was going to say, how many people died in that sequence?
We see at the end, we see a lot of, you know, people with their eyes poked out and broken arms, but that means there were other deaths that are unaccounted for. So we wanted to suggest a great deal of carnage and death.
The pteranodon attack, I've Googled them because I just sort of assumed that they were all pterodactyls, but I'm kind of a little ignorant on the dinosaurs, but they're not pterodactyls.
No, pterodactyls were from a bit of a different era. And, you know, all of them, you know, my dinosaur knowledge does not extend probably as far as you'd hope it would as a director
of
this movie.
It's my next 12 questions.
Yeah, no, you shouldn't be going into to dinosaur history with me, but I, you know, the pteranodon and the dimorphodon are real flying reptiles. They're not technically dinosaurs. But the dimorphodon is a new animal that we brought into this film that I was fascinated by because it's a flying animal with a dinosaur head. Mm. It's like a raptor head with wings, and it felt like a gremlin. You know,
that's interesting because the gremlins popped into my. You have a wide shot of them all sweeping in the air, and it's just utter carnage.
Yes,
and the gremlins popped into my head as like a kind of reference point for that.
So right, like the kitchen where you just get
it just
a big
feels
wide
completely
of everything
out of control.
Yeah.
Anarchy.
Well, I hope that you know shots like that, and that I presented it that way in hopes that on rewatch people can go back in and look at something different every time. And I think the first time you see it, there's so much that it's, especially in 3D, that it's hard to even process anything specifically that's happening. But there's a lot of little stories being told in those big shots. And when you go back, I wanted it to feel like a Bosch painting, like those triptychs with, you know, millions of different stories being told all at once. And there's great little buried moments. There's a shot in the shot you're talking about and another one when the boys are watching Zara about to get eaten. There, one of the dimorphodons has like a stuffed T-Rex toy, and he's all the stuffing is coming out. And, so we did very, you know, a lot of little gremlins-like kind of moments, and that was one of the best things about that group of extras is, you know, we were able to sort of reverse engineer, you know, moments of horror, because if an extra is running and they look back and then, you know, look over their shoulder and then put their hand on their back, like that informs a dimorphodon landing on them. And we had a lot of people went down that day. We mixed in stunt people with the crowd who would take these really brutal falls, and we'd have, you know, groups of several people take group falls. And it ends up, you know, in that particular one, I like the 3D in this movie a lot. I like the 2D version better because, you know, 3D has a tendency to make things feel more like rotoed than they are, and they're very well integrated. And when you see it on the Blu-ray, especially, they really are well integrated into that space. But that was a difficult sequence.
There's a nice moment in the main street chaos sequence where someone runs back to get a couple of cocktails.
Yeah. Do you know who that is?
No, it was that
Jimmy Buffett.
That was Jimmy Buffett. Yeah. Okay.
He just has to take his margaritas.
He's got
with
to get
him
his margaritas.
On the way.
Yeah.
And those are very, you know, I feel like my way of approaching, you know, Spielbergian references, the things that stand out to me are not just, you know, the moments of awe and the things that we all recognize, but there's always little, you know, moments of comedy that are his personality that he puts into them. And so we tried to have, you know, just these little vignettes here and there that, you know, keep a sense of levity amidst the horror.
Yeah, which worked really well. To go right back to the beginning of the movie, you start with an Amblin logo.
We do.
Which I think is the first time there's been a moving Amblin logo since Catch Me If You Can.
It's been a while, and this is the first time anyone's seen this one. We did a new one for this movie.
And was that your thing? Was that kind of
it was something that Steven had been thinking about for a while, and Frank really supported, and it was something that, you know, I think probably was encouraged by the fact that they were working with a fan. And someone who was a kid when all of their movies, you know, did what they did. And to me, it was just, you know, of course, you know, we should make a new Amblin logo. And why do we have, you know, Marvel and Pixar and Lucasfilm and these brands that assure you you're going to get something very specific that you love if you go to see a movie with that brand, but we don't have Amblin? Why not? And we should. And so let's make this an Amblin movie, and let's make more Amblin movies. And, you know, there's nothing in the marketplace that does what those movies do.
It felt like a mission statement.
Absolutely.
I wanted to go to the petting zoo. I love the idea that you have dinosaurs in a petting zoo saddled up for kids.
Yeah.
But also going back to the attack.
Yeah.
Is that there's a moment, isn't there, when I think one of the Triceratops, baby Triceratops, gets lifted.
Right. He's trying to pick him up.
But
he can't. Yeah.
And I just felt such a sense of relief that he didn't manage to take this baby Triceratops.
No, they're very lovable.
You couldn't let that one go.
No, I wouldn't want to hurt a baby. Oh, that'd be horrible. A baby Triceratops. I, you know, that idea of a child riding a Triceratops is certainly, you know, it's something that he tried to do in Jurassic Park. They were going to shoot that, and they couldn't. And we had a Crash McCreary drawing of that idea. And so we were able to place it in this movie and make it work. But it was the first day I was shooting, and I had my son, that's my son, who's laughing on the top of the baby Triceratops when we sort of pan up and you know, it was in the script, you know, I put it in there, you know, we see a giant dinosaur foot and you think it's going to be something large and it's in fact something small. But I wanted to make sure that it, you know, we didn't do a big wide establishing shot of that. We were in there with them, and it felt like you're part of that space, and that was something that's so crucial to that part of the movie, is that sense of immersion in a real theme park, and you know, all of the best parts of a theme park, and then also the really shitty parts. Like, it's also hot and you're in long lines and your kid's whining, and you know, we wanted to make sure all that stuff, you know, the complaining was in there too,
and the I just work here guy,
yeah, the gyrosphere, right? He was fantastic. He got big laughs.
I take great pride in my day players, is what they call the guy, you know, people who come in for one day that are often, you know, they have one or two lines, and people kind of toss that stuff off, and they don't think much about that. But I think that, you know, having people who are complete characters that you can look at and read into their life history immediately, and you know that guy, he's there every day. He probably smokes way too much weed, and he's sick of his job. And like the how mundane it is, the fact that you could be bored with this ride that is, you know, borders on sci-fi. And another day player whom I love is the girl who is announcing the Mosasaurus, just because she you know, it seems like you're at one of these parks, like, yeah, let's see if she's hungry today, everybody.
Thinking about her lunch.
Yeah.
The gyrosphere guy, just to go back to him, he reminded me a lot of the character in The Simpsons, the kind of the whiny-voiced guy who's always working tedious jobs. Was that a reference? Or
no,
that...
it's just him. You know, I saw him, and he felt... It's funny, you see all of these auditions, different people, and occasionally somebody comes along who just, their face tells a whole story. And he was one of those, Eric Edelstein, the guy who's the paddock worker who gets eaten.
The overweight paddock
worker. The overweight paddock worker. And what I loved being able to do is because a lot of these guys come from the improv world. And I'm really into, to, you know, improv comedy and UCB and their ability to find little moments always inspires me. And so I think we, you know, we're able to play kind of a yes and thing where, you know, there's a moment where Eric Edelstein is realizes that the dinosaur is broken out, but he still takes a second to finish the chip that he was eating. and that's, you know, it's subtle, but you know, it always cracks me up. It's the little things that crack me up.
The glasses that Lowry wears in the control room.
Yeah.
Are they based on Nedry's glasses? Are they the same glasses as Dennis Nedry?
Maybe subconsciously.
Subconsciously.
They are. Yeah, that's okay. Possible. You know, that was, I was actually thinking the mustache was, but either then I thought for some reason I assumed that Sam Jackson had a mustache in that movie, and I don't think he does, but I make these connections. Did he have a mustache?
I think he does. He does.
Okay.
Ray Arnold.
To me, it was more the mustache, if anything else, but, you know, that moment, the fact that Jake Johnson is wearing a vintage Jurassic Park t-shirt, is something that we did. You know, I wrote that little bit for him the day before because it was mostly about having, you know, these great character actors and wanting to make sure that they had something to do. And you know, I was, you know, a lot of this movie, the whole existence of this movie is, you know, it's based on Derek and I kind of writing what we know at a time when we were dealing with, you know, the needs of a massive corporation who wanted to bring back, this thing, whether it was a good idea or not. And so we wrote a movie about that. And that moment where Jake gets to sort of say what the whole audience is thinking at that point of, you know, why do you have to do this? Why are we here? You know, the real dinosaurs were good enough. What do you need these hybrids for? To me, that's just him talking everybody who has fears about this movie being their, you know, the worst parts of what we don't like about movies today. It sets everyone at ease and at least lets them know, look, we get it. Like, it's us too, and we're on your side, and now we're going to tell a story.
There's so much wonder in this movie and moments of sort of awe, but there is a slightly depressing notion that we just get bored of stuff, you know, and no matter how amazing it is, we're like, okay, that's a bloody T-Rex. I've seen one of those.
Yeah.
You need to keep, you know, which is, I guess, something from within us. I imagine as a filmmaker, you're at the sharp end of that. Like, you know, Mad Max has done this. I need to do that. We need to keep pushing it forward.
Well, no one can do what Mad Max did. My God. But, you know, but actually that, you know, the reaction to Mad Max got me very excited because I do feel like people, you know, when something comes along that is truly breathtaking and truly, you know, kind of crazy and amazing, people do acknowledge it. And, you know, they don't hate on something for the sake of hating on something. And it was kind of a great moment, so like in movie geek history when we all kind of, and I'm certainly, you know, we all got together and decided, you know what, we love this. And this is good, and it gave me great hope that when you do something right, and when you hit the notes that we're all hoping you hit, everyone will come together and say, you know what, yeah, cool.
Well, there's definitely moments of that in Jurassic World, and let's cut to the end and this amazing final battle, which is just dinosaur upon dinosaur pileup, with an amazing end note with the Mosasaurus. How quickly did you guys come up with that as the ending of the movie?
You know, it really, all of it stemmed out of, it's all character-based, and I consider all the dinosaurs to be characters, and it was much less about, you know, let's throw as many dinosaurs into the frame as we possibly can than it was a very natural set of results from all of these stories that we'd set up, and, it felt like Claire was on a journey from being a very corporate individual to somebody who was going to, you know, embrace that, you know, these are animals that are living things, and the choice that is made between the Indominus and Chris Pratt by the Raptor, like, you know, these were all things that I'm sure if you even read them in the screenplay, you'd imagine how the hell are they going to make that not ridiculous? And those are the kind of ideas that I love the most, is things that could be terrible, because oftentimes, you know, those are the things that are the best. You know, I'm sure if somebody sat you down and was like, you know, here's a movie idea. It's a guy and he can do magic. His father can do magic too, but he's part robot. And then he's got a friend with a dog buddy who flies around on a spaceship. And you're like, that's crazy. You're like, no, but you know, Star Wars is awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that the ending was kind of a culmination of like all of these ideas that could have been terrible that we thought we would just like throw on the roulette table and see if we could make them.
But
awesome.
You guys really go for it. And yeah. As soon as I realized what you were going to do with the T-Rex, I had a big goofy grin on my face because I didn't see it coming. It's astonishing when he's unleashed. Now, you've compared the T-Rex to Burt Lancaster in an interview.
Right.
Do you remember that?
That was a little bit, yeah, more of just like the way that when Burt Lancaster got old, his face actually got like tighter, you know, and he looked like stronger than he did when he was younger. But a little bit of Clint Eastwood. For sure.
I would have loved it if he'd emerged from the enclosure and just said, match me.
But that was, there was some fan who like tweeted me something like that with it, you know, they, I don't, whether they know the T-Rex is going to come out or not, the, anyone who doesn't want to get killed better get on out the back. that's the T-Rex's Clint Eastwood moment.
But you didn't have other sort of reference points for the other dinosaurs of
other human actors.
Because you had
actors
actually performing the raptors, didn't you?
We did. Yeah. We had performance capture for that and they, you know, we wanted them just to feel like animals, and they were a bit more avian than they've been in the other movies. They were a little more bird-like, and we wanted to really differentiate the reptilian kind of dinosaur from the avian dinosaur. And but when it comes down to the end, you know, the only other, you know, sort of movie-based reference we had was Rocky. You know, that final fight is essentially, you know, Rocky versus Apollo Creed, and you know, the T-Rex comes out, and you know, you have this, we have like our, you know, our high noon like Western shot where you're like looking over the hip of the T-Rex down at the other gunslinger, when that goes down, the fact that we take her down pretty fast and suddenly she's on the ropes and you're like, get up, Rocky, get up. Yeah. You know, to be able to create the kind of emotion that, you know, and then, you know, the raptor gets to come out and be Han Solo at the end of Star Wars and the Falcon. And, you know, you get these moments that as kids, you know, these are so ingrained in us, it's sort of, you're being able to channel all that into a dinosaur battle was like the nerdiest thing I ever did.
And you were saying before this that technically that was a really difficult thing to pull off.
Yes.
Push ILM to their limits a little bit.
Right. That's where I have to stop being a child and become an adult when I realize there's millions of dollars being spent on a single minute and 10 second long shot that involved a techno crane that turned into a dolly that turned into a camera on the back of a motorcycle. And all of these things were knit together into one piece. And the reason why I did it that way is, you know, we built this entire set. I wanted it all to be as practical as possible, at least in its environment. And I also didn't just want the movie to end with CG dinosaurs fighting each other. And so I had to integrate the people into it. And in order to do it in a way that isn't just cutting back and forth between all CG dinosaurs, humans watching in awe, all CG and back and forth, we had this long shot that suddenly you throw them right into the action and they're a part of it. And I don't know if it would work the way it does if they weren't in it.
I now want to see a kind of buddy dinosaur movie with the Mosasaurus and the T-Rex teaming up.
I know in the Lego game they've got a thing at the very end where it cuts to inside the Mosasaurus' stomach and it's the Indominus Rex and Zara like playing cards. That's a true story.
It's a sequel.
You mentioned Lego. I can't let this pass by without asking you. Chris Pratt obviously has his own Lego figure. Bryce, BD Wong, I think, has one. Vincent D'Onofrio has his own. Mm-hmm. There's no director Lego.
Oh, no, there is. I have a Lego. I'm in the video game.
But you don't have your own little Lego man, though.
They're going to make me one. Yeah, they're not going to sell it because nobody would buy it, but they're going to make
one. We would buy
it. There's actually, I'm in it, there's me, Steven's in it, and Frank's in it.
Amazing.
And you can actually, it's funny because they at the end of the Lego game, if you beat the whole thing, you can play the entire game as any of the available characters. So you could play the whole thing as me if you so chose. I don't know why you would do that.
Would you be a good character to play?
I, you know, with all of the other options, probably not. But I feel like, you know, my son will do it. There'll be one person in the world who play the whole Lego game is me.
I'm going to do it. I love those games, so I'm going to do it as well.
The game is incredible, but I've played the game, and I can endorse the hell out of that. It is awesome.
Some of the guys who make the Lego games listen to the podcast, so shout out to them.
They know how much I love it. It's incredible.
You are in the movie.
My voice.
Yeah.
My voice is
You
the
are
movie.
Mr. DNA.
I am the voice of Mr. DNA.
An iconic character.
Yeah. And that actually came out of a temp thing We were doing the temp mix, you know, when you show the movie to the studio, we went in and did like a week long just to make it sound like a movie. And so I went into the booth and did the line real quick, and we always assumed we were going to hire somebody to do it. And we EQ'd a little bit, and we found a place where it, you know, it actually sounded like him. So we kept it in the film, and I asked Brad Bird to come in and do a voice. He's the voice of the monorail announcer as they're heading through. And I sent him, the, you know, as I do with a lot of people, even who have one line, I sent him this like really detailed character description of what he was. Yeah. And it was like, you know, you live in North Hollywood, and you're writing screenplays by night, and you do the tour by day. And you know, like, I did it for you too.
Like, gave me a fantastic sort of backstory for Edmund.
Right.
My iconic character.
Yeah. Everybody needs a story.
Yeah. What was your Mr. DNA line?
I remember he says something about the building blocks of life, and when John Hammond, yeah. You know, that's I won't do it on the air. You got to see that.
You got to pay to see that.
Yes.
There's been talk online of the Stegoceratops. I'm not sure how much you delve into the forums and all that kind of stuff, but
I'll tell the story of the Stegoceratops. So here's what happened. There initially was a scene in an earlier draft of the script that Derek and I wrote. There was a scene where while Bryce and Chris were out in the jungle, they came across another hybrid, and it was a scene that informed them that, you know, under her nose, without her knowledge, Dr. Wu has been making other hybrids. And the reason why it's a Hasbro toy is that those toys are locked like a year out. And, you know, I thought I would put the scene in the movie. And so they made the toy. And then my son, who's six now, he was five at the time, and he watched Return of the Jedi for the first time. And he saw it and he loved it. But then he said, you know, Dad, you know, if Leia is also a Jedi, that means Luke isn't unique. I was like, huh, okay. And then I applied that for some reason to this other thing that meant, you know, I felt like there could be only one. You know, the idea that there was more than one made it not like the synthetic amongst all organics that had to go. And suddenly it just seemed entirely wrong to have it in the movie. And the minute that I decided it was wrong, I just suddenly hated the idea. And so it was excised like right away. But the toy still exists. So like this remnant of something that was never shot.
It was never shot.
It was cut in the script stage. No. Yeah. We have a couple deleted scenes, not many. The only deleted scene that is really of note, there's a scene where Chris and Bryce are walking through the jungle, and he has her, you know, put dinosaur shit all over her body.
That's in one of the TV spots.
They use it in some of the spots in order to cover up the scent for the dinosaurs. And it is a very funny scene. And Steven really loves people rubbing dinosaur shit all over each other. Like he really loves it. And he was suggesting that the boys do it. And we were like, well, maybe we can make kind of part of the romance and we can do it like this. And so we shot it. It isn't cut because it doesn't work as a scene. It was cut because at that point in the movie, you know, we have the tension ratcheted up to a certain point, and for suddenly for the two of them to be, you know, engaged in this kind of romantic comedy banter on that level with the amount of intensity going on around them just felt very out of place, and so I took it out.
It's just as well this film isn't in Smell-O-Vision, because Chris Pratt has petrol all over him the entire movie, pretty much, doesn't he?
Right. That was always the whole movie, and then, you know, if we had kept the scene in, he would have had petrol and dinosaur poop on it. That was always, for some reason, Derek, he always was very deeply bothered by the fact. He's like, no, but he's got, like, feces on him. Like, he has to wash that off. Like, he's just from a sanitation standpoint, he's like, we got to cut this scene. We can't do it.
I wonder what the hardest scene to say goodbye to was for you when you were in the editing suite. Because it's a very trim film. There's no fat on the bones, and it moves at a whip, and there's no scenes that drag. There must have been things that you're like,
There was one thing, you know, and you'll see, we put all the first cut of the movie was 2 hours and 10 minutes, and the movie is now 2 hours and 4. I mean, I guess 1:57, you don't count all the credits. So there's no like 3-hour version of Jurassic World. And what was cut were mostly bits in the middle with the boys traveling through the jungle. And there's one just really nice little moment where the two of them are sitting on a log after having jumped off the waterfall, and the little boy takes out like a tiger's milk bar out of his you know, his little nerd pouch, dork pouch, whatever his brother calls it, and he's, you know, he's got it, and he's kind of mad at his brother for having gotten him into this situation, and he looks at him and he breaks it in half and gives it to the brother, and then the two of them climb up to the top of this hill and they look out, and the older brother's he's like, no, no, you got this. And then he takes off his Jurassic World band and he throws it aside, kind of pissed off. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you're, if you want something to move, you know, mm-hmm. it has to go. But I love those boys. I think that we've pulled off a Jurassic Park movie where you're not annoyed by the children.
Yeah, you did, actually.
You know, and I take great pride in that. And yet, you know, there's some stuff on the Blu-ray that I think if you like the movie, you really are going to like. There, it's, you know, I usually deleted scenes. You watch them, you're like, yep, that definitely didn't need to be there. and these things, I think you can see why narratively they would go, but they're consistent and they're equally, I think, entertaining as the rest of the film that they're in.
I wanted to also mention a particular moment which got a big laugh in the screening, which was between your old pal Jake Johnson and Lauren Lapkus's, the two of them. They've got this kind of thing between them in the control center throughout the film, and it plays on the disaster movie cliche of that we're gonna die, we may as well have a last snog, and he's misread the signs so horrifically. I mean, I would never put myself in that situation. I guess everyone can kind of relate to that horrible sort of misreading of the signs. I it seemed to me that it was a moment where sort of Jake Johnson's character almost kind of knows he's doing that. He's like, he's seen the disaster movies and he's kind of playing on that himself. So there's layers to it.
Someone has to stay behind.
Yeah, which particular films he'd seen. And he'd like, this is like, he's just the Poseidon Adventure, the Towering Infernos flashed through his mind.
Well, he, you know, Jake Johnson's character is all of us. You know, he's Empire Readers, he's me, he's you. And from the start to the finish, the fact that he's wearing that, you know, vintage Jurassic Park shirt that he got off of eBay for like $500. And so we, you know, Jake and I built that character and Lauren as well. You know, Lauren was essentially, you know, she had a couple lines. She didn't really have much to do in the movie. And I asked her, because I think she's a great improvisational actor and does a lot of work with the UCB as well. And so I asked her to come in and I just said, look, we're going to find something great that's going to make your character have some real value. And that we did in a lot of ways. And Jake the same. And that moment wasn't in our script. It was something that we did at the last minute and we actually shot it both ways. We do have footage of him kissing her.
Really?
He does. He does get the girl in one option, and I even put it in the original, one of the first cuts. I put it in that he kissed her, and then we didn't have Bryce kissing Chris. I knew I could only pull off one kiss in this movie. Like, couldn't have two. there could be only one, as I said before. And you know, but it's one of those moments that I think feels very true to anyone who ever kind of like stepped outside their comfort zone and took a shot. It's actually certainly the most personal touch in the movie for me. And it's just one of those moments that you reckon, if you've seen Safety Not Guaranteed, that you just recognize like, yep, that's that guy. Yeah. Especially it being, Jake and I and Derek specifically. And it's the idea that at a moment where we're at peak carnage and peak fear that we can have something that is a surprise, you know, that's just me trying to have a surprise in a movie, which is so hard to do now. And I think it's less about something, you know, jumping out at you when you least expect it. It's like, you know, let's have a moment that you're laughing because you can't believe this is happening in this movie right now.
One more very quick question for me. I wondered, what happened to the helicopter pilot? It's the who shot nice guy Eddie of your movie. Where is he? Is he still on the island?
That's Pat Crowley. One of our producers. He ultimately, the reason why he wasn't in there, you know, we needed the ACU guys in there because they were going out on a mission. And she says as she's coming out and she's like, oh, he must have gotten cut up in the evacuation. So we just figured that, you know, he's met a lady and he's out having his own time. Like he's oblivious to like what's going on.
I had a feeling he might
be
having a fag or something and he's going to come back.
And he's going to come back and be like, where's the helicopter?
Where's everyone gone?
He's probably off with the girl Edmund was meant to meet.
Exactly. But, that's the
tragic story.
That's right. The Spanish girl.
Nick Robinson's character. Yeah. What happens with him and his girlfriend? I was invested in that.
Oh, you're
yeah. What happens? It's very kind of ambiguous.
Yeah, I guess you'll never. I think that Nick. I love the way that character changes, and he represents to me something that, we do with two characters in this movie. I love it when you're allowed to not really like a character at first, and then, he's not doesn't do anything likable. He's just kind of a jerk to his brother, and he's disrespectful of this girl, and Claire isn't necessarily that likable at first too. And to be able to take someone to a point from where you dislike them to where you love them, I did it in Safety as well. You don't really like Aubrey Plaza. you're like, what the hell's going on with Mark Duplass? And that's something I hope to continue to do. I don't know what his resolution is, but I do know that he's, you know, his relationship with his brother is forever changed. And I think that, there's a real danger in becoming maudlin, you know, when you traffic in those kinds of stories. And I felt by keeping it as simple as possible and making it as universal as possible, we would pull it off. And, you know, I think having a moment where people who have been through traumatic experiences are able to connect on a deeply emotional level that is as pure as I think, you know, brothers are.
Yeah. I was also emotionally invested in Vic Hoskins' Wolf Pup and that whole story.
We should put that on the Blu-ray. There's a last part of that conversation that I loved that we should make sure people see. But after he talks about his wolf pup, he says, yeah, you know, I took that wolf and I put it in the ring with one of my buddy's pit bulls. And, you know, the pit got a hold of his scruff early and just wouldn't let up.
Wow.
And he goes into this kind of like, you know, this really emotional moment and then he looks up at Omar and is like, that's not going to happen here, right? it was a great moment. And it's one of those things that, you know, obviously for pacing, you know, these things go out. But I may have gotten a bit too character-based with that, but I did love that.
I enjoyed it. He's a fun, hissable villain. You must be happy about Daredevil coming out, you know, a few months before and everyone being on the Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah, he got that while he was on the set, and he was so excited about it. It's funny because we had to he had to do a little bit of ADR, of dialogue replacement for us, and I asked him to record this line, and he sent back this dialogue where he was like, yeah, we got to go find the helicopter. And I'm like, dude, that's not what your character sounds like at all. Like, what is that? And he's like, I'm sorry, man. I've been playing Kingpin, and I can only talk like him. I don't know how to talk like Hoskins anymore. It took a while to, like, get him out of it and get him to talk like the other character. He went that deep into Kingpin.
Wow.
And we have to ask, there's been internet chatter about Jurassic World 2, about another sequel. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there have been conversations about it, and that there is stuff in this movie which seems to, you know, not be tied up in terms of InGen arriving and taking embryos off the island and all that kind of stuff. Can you say anything about that?
The purpose of it, and is something that I promise Steven that I would do, is create, at least just create a scenario where we had a lot of avenues to go down and be able to open it up into a bigger, not necessarily universe. You don't want to use that word anymore because suddenly there's going to be a Jurassic World universe. And I don't think there should be. I don't think there can be. I think these are very singular experiences, these movies, and they are in danger of all feeling like remakes of the one before. And yet there is an idea that I'm very interested in and intrigued by, which is, you know, if you apply what happened with, you know, nuclear power to dinosaurs, you know, that started very small and then it was used for a weapon and then for power itself. And it spread to the point where there's now, 22 different, you know, entities or countries that have that capability. And, you know, the ability to make a dinosaur has always been localized to InGen and to Jurassic Park. And what if that goes open source? And what if there's a world where, you know, many, many different kinds of interests can make a dinosaur? And I think there's room in that, and there's also room in exploring further a world where we have the same relationship with dinosaurs that we do with other animals on this planet. Like, imagine, you know, there are lions in that jungle. Don't go in there or you'll get eaten, but we recognize that they're there. And I think there's space for it. I'm not sure if I'm going to be the one that carries it on, certainly not from a directorial standpoint. I think that this franchise actually would be better served, in my personal opinion, at this moment in time, by having different directors in the way they're doing with Star Wars. Like, I think that each of those Star Wars movies are going to be very personal and very different and completely new visions. And I think they need that. And I think this franchise could use that as well. There's some pretty cool, you know, Spanish horror directors that I'd love to see their Jurassic Park movie, you know, as a fan.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Henry Wu solo movie.
Yeah, see about that. I don't know. It certainly doesn't have the breadth of, like, the universe isn't quite as deep as Marvel and Star Wars and all those. So these movies are different, and that's why it's important that, you know, we're very careful and we don't run this thing into the ground. And that's something that I'm going to be a big advocate of.
One very quick final question. You were kind enough to let me jump in and have a very short cameo in this, which was amazing. Is it true that you cameoed in Ghostbusters 2?
Well, what I don't know is if you can see me in the movie. I know I went when I was a child. I probably was like 11 or so. It came out in 1989, and I went to Kerner Optical, which is where ILM used to be out in San Rafael. And I was one of – I got in a costume, and I was one of the ghosts walking off the Titanic.
Oh, wow.
When they amazing. Said the Titanic is show back up. So, I've always – and I haven't. I've always wanted to get a Blu-ray. Yeah. And go see if I pause it, and just in the way I'm sure you'll do with this movie, although you'll have more success than me because you're clearly visible in this movie. And I don't know if you did it on purpose, but there's a guy who as the bleachers are sinking down to look at the Mosasaurus, somebody stands up and I used it because that guy stood up. It made the whole thing feel like it was going down. It's like, oh, that works. It turns out it was you.
Hey,
amazing stuff.
It wasn't on purpose. I was probably just like
he's a pro, seasoned pro. Colin Trevorrow, thank you so much for coming in to chat to us about Jurassic World. Thank you kindly for your time today, and best of luck for the release.
Colin Trevorrow there, he was amazing. Lovely guy. He brought us champagne.
He brought us a bottle of champagne.
Champagne.
From his hotel room, which was very nice. Very nice of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good, good, good. Okay, so got a lot to talk about in Jurassic World. Let's just go around the table very, very quickly and gauge our general reaction to the film. Are we in the for camp or are we in the against camp? Helen, where are you? Where do you stand?
I'm somewhat moderate. There's a lot of fun to be had in it. But I have notes.
It's too late, Helen. They've made it. Finished.
Phil Camp.
I really enjoyed it. My expectation levels were set at a very reasonable level, I would say.
Yeah.
It's not remotely as close to being as good as the first one, but I thought it was really fun. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I was definitely in the four camp.
Best since the first one, I would say?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
No, I enjoyed it very much. I have quibbles or quibblesauruses, but... Yeah, it was a really good time. It's a weird kind of all quasi remake of the original. It's half sequel, half remix almost.
You can almost overlay it on top of the first film in a way, can't you? You know, it ends with raptors pursuing people at the end through the park.
And I liked a lot of that stuff. I liked a lot of the callbacks, but there was maybe a little bit too much. Maybe I would have liked it to have been a bit more of its own thing. But lots of great action and.
I'm the same. I wrote The Empire Review. I gave it 4 stars. I thought it was terrific. It has flaws. It has flaws as big as an Indominus Rex, but I think the ride is enough to make you forgive most of those. We'll get into them, I guess. I wonder if any of the deleted scenes gave more depth to Katie McGrath's character, Sarah, the sort of assistant who just got a little bit careless, lost the boys, was a bit preoccupied with her BlackBerry or whatever, and ended up paying for it with a horrible death, quite frankly. Yeah.
The most protracted and grotesque death. And
Since the end of The Naked Gun.
Pretty much.
If a steamroller would come along at the end and finished her off, that would have...
It's kind of... It was a weird one. I get what Trevorrow had said, in interviews, that it's about, kind of surprising you and killing someone who doesn't deserve to die, particularly. You know, these things usually function as a bit of a morality play. The bad people die first and worst. Generally speaking, and that really kind of wasn't the case with her. Yes, she lost them, but she wasn't an inherently awful person, and she gets a really awful death.
But cool,
yeah,
pretty cool.
Yeah, no, cool. I'm not
it
saying
was just,
it
just
cool.
It doesn't really match the if it happened to that grizzled bearded merc who shoots nonchalantly shoots one of the dinosaurs and grins. You kind of would have gone okay.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. Yeah, and it's but I get the surprise factor, but it did feel very weird as a result.
It felt. I was watching it because we've seen it. Who's seen it twice now here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Three of us have. And second time particularly, I was going, she's done nothing. I mean, deserves got nothing to do with it, as a great man once said. But I was just sitting there going, she really doesn't deserve this. I mean, she's being pecked to bits by pterodons or, whatever they are, dinosaur experts. And, then she's dropped into a pool. And then I know why they did it with the Mosasaur, to remind people that the Mosasaur is there. So when it pops out at the end and goes, hello, then you're not going, oh, right, okay, I forgot about that thing. But that's a bit over the top.
It's weird though, because I think he very much undercuts our whole expectations of morality and so on here. Because I think it's interesting as well with the Owen character, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this more. But Owen, he thinks it's terrible that his velociraptors could possibly be used for warfare. Mm-hmm. But my question to you is this: what the hell does he think he's training them for, if not warfare?
That's a good question.
I mean, he says we've done hunt drills 1,000 times. For what? What do you think you're training them for, if not for war? Maybe so football. Presumably it's second thoughts.
Catching any loose pigs.
I mean, from what D'Onofrio says, he is actually, you know, been brought on to train them for this and now is having second thoughts.
Helen, but that loose makes pigs him a is bad a major person. Problem. It's loose a major pigs. Problem.
Yeah. There's one in the office right now, just squealing around.
Loose.
Haunted, the haunted pig. I think that he's maybe not the sharpest tool in the box.
You think that beautiful, beautiful, muscly Owen Grady is not also an intellectual?
No.
Well, you've just turned my world upside down.
He likes bikes and board shorts and stuff, yeah, but dude. Come on. Yeah. Yeah. He's a bit of a dim bulb at times, isn't he? Maybe he hasn't really thought it through properly.
He's on a payroll, so it is hard to really know
what he's up to there. It's an interesting thing because the movie's coolest image, which is on all the posters of him on his motorbike unleashing all the raptors, is something he is against, and the movie is kind of against because, you know, it leads to lots and lots of people getting killed. It's a terrible idea.
But they could have been.
Some of them might have been nice. Some of them might have been nice.
Some of them, they've all got families, probably.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it could have been Paul Barry.
It could have been. My question is, poor Barry. My question is. Not just what's he training the raptors for. Why did they have raptors on the park at all? Because I didn't get a sense that they were being used as an attraction.
No, they didn't seem to be.
I can get why you wouldn't have raptors as an attraction, given their propensity for escaping and killing everyone, but why have them at all?
Well, maybe the plan was to, like the Mosasaurus, that they were planning to eventually put on some kind of show for tourists at that thing. That he was training them so that you could have a raptor, on a tightrope, on a bicycle kind of show.
That's what I took out of it. It was going to be some lion taming. They would leap through hoops, blazing hoops.
Wow.
On bikes. That's plausible. So he's a one-man Siegfried and Evil Sauruses. So he's Siegfried and Roy. But I got that impression that they were training it, you know, like they presumably trained the Mosasaurus to expect that that's how it's going to be fed. That there was some end game in terms of like an attraction.
Yeah.
And then the military industrial sideline came along and thought, oh, hello, we'll have a piece of that. And we'll put them in the tunnel network of Tora Bora. It would have cleared out Al-Qaeda. How? Seriously? I mean, come on.
Well, in fairness, if you saw a raptor coming at you, you'd
Yeah.
You'd be worried.
This is all stuff
from the John Sayles draft, which is online. You can find it fairly easily, and it's absolutely demented. It has dinosaurs parachuting out of a plane. It has a third act in which they're in the jungles of South America, and raptors have got cameras attached to their heads, like in Jurassic World, but they're, you know, taking down drug dealers. Infiltrating a compound with a guy called Nick, who is basically the Owen character.
Did you write this?
And it's also got Dilophosauruses with laser beams and stuff.
Frickin' laser beams attached to their heads.
It's the greatest thing ever.
It's basically Dr. Evil. We did actually miss out on a cutaway to the families of the deceased security team. That would have been brilliant in the middle of this.
Yeah.
Okay, so I can kind of... If they are being trained to basically be performing lions, then that would be something that would make a vague sort of sense.
I have a question, quickly. Okay. Yep. Why does Owen punch Vic Hoskins?
Because he man, and man no like other
what
man.
What has Vic Hoskins done at that point?
Vic Hoskins he's just reveled in it, hasn't he? He's just like, you can tell that he just likes the fact that everyone's dying, and his evil plan, which is kind of vague and undefined, is slowly clicking into place.
I liked Vic Hoskins. I really liked him. I savoured his pantomime nefariousness.
I think my favourite Vic Hoskins moment in the film is when the park is descending into chaos and all the flappy birds are flying around killing people, and... And he walks up on the roof of the observation center, and he just grins evilly.
I love it.
And then there's another bit where Owen goes away. It's like the park is beginning to descend to chaos, and I think it's Barry actually goes, "Oh no, we have a situation here." And Oscar's like, "Oh no, that's terrible. That's terrible to hear a situation." Then Barry leaves the frame, and he immediately calls Dr. Wu and goes, "Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen."
I noticed on the second viewing that he has a nice line in hen-based metaphors. He has at least two, like it's a hen and a fox. You know, he's constantly talking about hens. So I wonder if he's got a little book in his pocket of hen metaphors.
My big book of hen metaphors by Vic Hoskins. We have a Hoskins-related question later on, but here's another couple ones from Gareth Griffiths, who sent in loads. He says, was the CGI good enough?
Do you know what? I had a bit of a thing about this. So I've been writing a piece recently about Stan Winston and all the work, you know, combining CG and practical effects on the first film and indeed the second and the third films. And I kind of wish they'd done a little bit more practically. I feel like they could have done. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine it's that much more expensive. Genuinely, I really, really can't, because the amount of money that goes into CG as well is pretty astonishing.
Mm. It's interesting having talked to the sort of the producers and the director of this that Trevorrow had to really argue and fight to get that one legacy animatronic into the movie.
And which one is that? Is that the Brachiosaurus?
It's the it's in Apatosaurus.
Apatosaurus, the dying one.
The one that you see the neck and the head, which is wonderful. I really love that scene, and I love that you can really feel the difference.
You can feel the difference, and that's the thing, because I was looking at that scene, and I'm like, I feel like this is real, and I get it, and I like it. And then I was looking at the raptor heads in the cages. You remember when they've got them in those sort of little muzzle things? Mm. I'm like, that doesn't look real, and I can't see any reason why that wouldn't be. That to me is a perfect example of something that should have been real. And quite frankly, also the little baby plant eaters that the babies are riding in the petting zoo, which is a genius idea. Mm. Absolutely genius. Apparently it comes from the first film. But,
yeah, it comes from a Crash McCreary concept art. I mean, the original film.
That 100% on board.
I said that actually before the film came out, because that was a shot of that in the TV spot. And I tweeted, I think, why was this not practical?
Why were they not practical?
Or a combination of, you know, the Triceratops could 100% have been a practical...
Yeah.
I didn't understand.
Apart from anything else, you could just use those for the theme park.
Yeah.
Like a real theme park in real life. You could have a little baby ride along an animatronic.
I 100% agree. Yeah. And I think there is stuff when the foot of the Indominus comes down and Chris Pratt's under the car. Mm-hmm. It could have been a practical foot. Yeah. It could have been. Mm-hmm. And I'm baffled as well. Because,
as it was on the original film with the T-Rex.
Yeah, and I'm baffled as well, because that T-Rex sequence in the original film uses digital and practical so well.
Yeah.
And I feel like you can really tell that this is all digital. The Indominus is all digital.
Yeah, like the especially the towards the end. But the Mosasaur for me never felt real, and even the shark that hangs down as they're about to feed it. That just even from the trailers, right from the off, I just thought it doesn't. It's not listening the right way.
Cat Brown, formerly of this parish, would like me to ask at this point, why the hell they're feeding it with great white sharks? I mean, obviously it's a very funny in-joke for film fans, Jaws, etc. But white sharks are also endangered.
When we did the trailer breakdown, we asked Colin Trevorrow about that, and he said that they have a great white shark cloning facility on the island.
Mm-hmm. So of course they do. I did think they must be producing them. The other thing is that they said that the Indominus Rex cost, I think they said $6 million, because I've listened twice because I was surprised by it both times. Mm. And they said it was $6 million development. That seems insanely low.
Woo, syringes are very expensive. That's low or high?
That really low. Really, really crazy low.
Daffy doesn't say a billion, no?
Please, listeners, listen yourselves. It sounds very much like million to me, and that sounds incredibly low. That would be, frankly, less than it probably costs to make it in CG.
Yeah, so, it's less than the costs the average theme park to make a roller coaster.
Yeah.
So, wow. Okay.
I agree with everything that you've said about the CG. It doesn't feel quite like, although it has, and I wonder how much the fact that the dinosaurs were performance captured some of the time makes it simpler or harder for rendering and compositing the CG compared to the first Jurassic Park movie. But that awe that we all felt when we first saw the dinosaur reveal in the park in the first film, it's really impossible to replicate nowadays.
It's interesting. We're getting off the beaten path here a little bit with this point. Sorry about that. But in the first film, I think the first time we really hear the Jurassic Park theme, you know, the majestic, sweeping Jurassic Park theme, is that shot of the park in its all its glory, and you see all the dinosaurs in the distance, and the, you know, and our experts are just awestruck by it. And the first time we hear the Jurassic Park theme in this movie is a shot of the park itself. And I just thought that kind of reflected different priorities.
Well, they were hiding. They were holding back on the dinosaurs, I
know,
guess.
Yeah, I know. And I know that the film has this cake and eat it in terms of, oh, look at all this product placement stuff and we're going to smash it. But it also, it just felt, I don't think that's that it, the park itself.
Yeah, it's funny. Circularities. I mean, it's a film about, the theme of the film is, you know, how to combat diminishing returns in terms of surprise and expectation and fun. And then boredom kicking in. I think that's what they were combating as well a little bit. We've seen this stuff before. How do you make it better, bigger, more exciting? And I think they did, you know, we should talk about the ending of the film, perhaps that last fight sequence when they unleash the T-Rex.
the Avengersaurus.
When it comes out Clint Eastwood style with a poncho and a cheroot in its mouth and it's like, let's go to work.
Yeah.
But if you look at the camera work, and he talked about it with me and Nick, the actual sequence itself and integrating human characters into the action as well in a way that the first film couldn't do. Mm. There are subtle improvements in the action.
Yeah, I mean, the big effect shots that you absolutely can't do with practical stuff, I don't mind. And that final fight sequence I absolutely loved. I had no problem with that. It's the little moments, the little shots, the claw coming through the gyrosphere.
Yeah.
Yes.
That just looks fake to me. That is something, surely you can get a giant claw going through some glass or something. You know, there needs to be something practical in that shot. And it looked fake in the trailers, it looked fake in the film, and that's the kind of stuff. But the whole final stretch of the movie I loved, so...
Yeah. It looks better in the film than in the trailer.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it just does.
Well, it's presumably more finished. for one reason, I'm guessing.
Yeah. But they work on these shots. I mean, the shot of Zara, all the stuff with the Mosasaur and the flying things... They had that on set because when they were shooting the film, there was an ILM guy sitting there with a laptop, and he was, and it looked fairly far along that shot. Mm. They start working on these shots before they start shooting anything with actors. So these shots are being baked for 2-3 years.
Yeah. One thing I would say is that I think certainly I saw the film twice in 3D. I don't know if any of you have had the chance to see it in 2D yet because that's the way it's been screened to us. But I think the conversion is a big problem in this one. And I think the reason it's a problem is that there are so many things involving leaves. And leaves are incredibly difficult to convert into 3D. And what you have, if you're actually... I'm going to really ruin the experience for anyone. If you're going to see it in 3D again, maybe you've seen it already, but you're going back, watch what's happening with the leaves and the forest. There's one scene where they're panning in towards the control center and... Because they've tried to convert it, it actually looks like this entire row of trees is rolling towards the control center rather than you rolling over the top of it. It's really, really distracting. If you start looking at the leaves in this thing, it doesn't work. Honestly, I don't think you should convert anything involving complex structures like that. Mm. I just don't think you should.
Colin Trevorrow actually recommends the 2D version over the 3D, so that kind of says it all. It seems to be more and more the case with directors these days that they're getting 3D foisted on them.
Yeah, I think the CG holds up an awful lot. I think it there's some terrific sequences that clearly you couldn't have done practically. And I think our good friend the Indominus Rex is so big and so dexterous that I don't think they could have really done a practical
If she's 50 feet long, she's only 6 feet longer than the Spinosaurus in number 3, which was 44.
Was she fully grown? Because I got confused. Because when they're having the conversation, somebody says, I think Wu says, when she's fully grown... She'll be bigger than the T-Rex.
Yeah, and then he goes, she already is.
Yeah.
Immediately afterwards.
Yeah.
So
I was slightly puzzled around that. The Indominus, we could talk about the Indominus now.
Yeah, well, just one more thing about the raptor plot holes. The scheme to unleash the raptors on the Indominus, what was the thinking there? Because obviously in the first film, the raptors got monstered by the T-Rex at the end, right?
That did cross
my mind, and the Indominus is more powerful than the T-Rex. So what exactly were they hoping that?
I think they were hoping they'd track him and hold him still long enough for them to kill him.
That's exactly
her. Her.
Yeah. With what?
That's exactly with their heavy duty weapons, which they had.
Did they?
Yes.
Yeah. They have all those mercs. Yeah.
Oh.
They had like big explodey things.
There's a whole scene of them shooting at the Spinosaurus. There's a whole scene of them shooting at the Indominus Rex.
All right, that kind of makes sense.
Did you guys spot the Spinosaurus cameo?
No. In fact, we have a question here. We have a question which ties into that from Matthew in Belgium, who says, debate this if you please. Where is Spinosaurus in this park? Okay, the one on Site B might have been killed in Jurassic Park 3, but doesn't this badass beast look like something you'd want to put in your dinosaur park before you try and make a new one? Plus, according to the latest research, he could swim as well.
This is a real Spinosaurus fanboy, which are few and far between. Well,
you included pictures.
Yeah, can I see?
Oh, cool!
Look at these pictures.
Oh, cool!
These
are
great. Pictures on the podcast, folks. This is fun.
This is a first. We're breaking new ground here. So the Spinosaurus is a controversial beast in the sort of Jurassic Park canon because in the third film, the Spinosaurus takes down the T-Rex, and people got incredibly angry about this. Mm. People are still angry about this, and the T-Rex gets its revenge in this film, which I thought was a really nice touch. So basically, when the T-Rex is let out of its enclosure and is stomping down Main Street, there is a Spinosaurus skeleton which is hanging on Main Street.
Yes.
And it's just the ribcage and everything. The T-Rex smashes through it and explodes.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, and that's like the T-Rex getting its revenge.
Oh,
I have
bravo.
To say, yeah, because that pissed me off in Jurassic Park 3. That pissed me off. I mean, I know that science, blah, 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 and bigger and whatever, but, you know, sometimes the underdog wins. Sometimes.
The Spinosaurus is the coat here. Yeah.
Well, apparently not.
Sometimes the sun goes around the moon.
I was reading that fight in Jurassic Park.
Sometimes the snow falls down.
Stop
the
it. Pull him out of this, someone.
Don't save the best for last, Chris. Just don't do it. The Spinosaurus and the T-Rex fight in 3, apparently a lot of that they did do practically. They had the models actually fighting because they were so powerful and so fast at that point that a lot of it they actually did practically.
Wow.
And the Spinosaurus model also ganked the T-Rex model. So
ganked.
It's like it was a thorough victory in fiction and in reality. The Spinosaurus won that fight.
So. The word of the
day. Not in this one.
Ganked.
It did have an unfair disadvantage in that it was a skeleton in this one. But I think it still counts as a resounding victory. So the Indominus, Rex, not the I-Rex, apparently. I've asked two different people this, and it's not the I-Rex.
It hasn't stopped people calling it the I-Rex. I've seen that a little on Twitter.
It sounds like something you would take for irritable bowel syndrome. Yeah.
You think that the focus
or the
group
Apple
would
make.
The I-Rex. Maybe they've copyrighted it already.
Maybe.
When they inevitably... Make
there's a moment when Bryce Dallas Howard says, you know, why do you call it the Indominus Rex? And she goes, well, the focus group said, you know, whatever name, you know, she says an impossible name, was very difficult to pronounce. Four-year-olds couldn't say it. And how many four-year-olds can say Indominus Rex? Rex, yes.
Yeah.
But the Indominus...
Well, tiny children being very familiar with dinosaur names, then, maybe. Yeah. Indominus, of course, meaning untamable. I looked that up the other day, so I'm going to share it with everyone as often as possible.
Yeah.
It's here's my big problem with the Indominus Rex. Not in the design, not in the execution. My big problem is, did nobody watch it while it was growing up and notice, hey, look, it's changing color? Did no one at any point think?
It only did it when it needed to, Helen.
But how did it know
Because it's Hannibal Lecter.
it's like the aliens in, I think it was Alien Resurrection, where they seem to know they have acid blood and they cut themselves up to bleed on things to get through things.
Yeah, that's very stupid.
How do they know?
You have to buy into the idea that this creature is the most intelligent thing that has ever... But fiendish.
It's a good point, though. How does any animal know? How does a chameleon know that it can blend in with this background? They just know.
But then they know because they've done it, presumably.
Because they've had thousands of years of breeding, I guess, but...
Maybe she saw her sibling do it?
At some point, the first chameleon went, I'm invisible to everything. This is awesome. I should do this more.
And also, how did it know it could change back? Could have been a crisis for it. I've changed and now no one can see me and I can't get fed anymore and I'm not ready for my plan.
And how does thermal imaging work with cold-blooded reptiles anyway?
Ah, they're not cold-blooded.
They're warm-blooded.
Okay.
They say that in there's a line in the original movie.
So how did the thermal imaging cease to work for it once it had...
And again,
did
how did it know that it was being watched thermally?
Because it's read the script.
It had genuinely read the script.
Yeah, it's so intelligent. Because the T-Rex can't read scripts because its arms are so small. But the Indominus Rex has bigger arms, so it can flip through pages.
Then I take back all my
Well, there you go.
It had also seen Predator and Aliens. Because when it ambushes the squad...
Yes.
That's clearly an homage to Aliens.
It really is.
The beginning of Aliens.
And
it knows that they're watching the body count back at headquarters.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's taking them out one by one specifically as a homage.
And it's fading up out of the jungle just like Predator.
Speaking of movie references, I can't take credit for this, but somebody on a forum that I saw pointed out that basically this is Rambo First Blood, but with Rambo as the villain of the movie. So it's someone who's trained to be a lethal killing machine who goes crazy in a sort of jungle stroke forest and starts taking down everyone who goes after it. Hmm. It's Rambo. And at no point does it put a red headband on.
Well, if the Indominus Rex had... If there had been a scene of it sewing up the wound after it clawed the tracking device out of it, then I'd go with that theory. But
I'm not saying that this dinosaur's actually Rambo. I'm just saying there are parallels. I'm not saying that this is actually Stallone in dinosaur form somehow.
You've reminded me about Owen Grady and that chunk of Indominus back flesh with the thing in it. He carried that around with him for the entire movie. Because there's a bit at the end where he suddenly... He's got it at the beginning, and then suddenly he needs to... He just whips it out of his, his knapsack or something.
Oh, wow.
Sniffs. Yeah. Do you remember? The raptors to have a sniff so they can track it.
Ah.
You're like, have you been really carrying that large chunk of flesh around with you? And no one's gone, Owen, you
seem to be carrying... I don't remember him finding it.
Yeah, and no, I don't remember him finding it.
No, yeah, he somebody didn't does have find it. Somebody else must
something,
have
somebody
it
else had it.
He had this.
I think somebody,
somebody went out to collect the bodies. Here's another question. With the gyroscope, right? Mm. Which, first of all, as a lawyer, can I just say, even before the events of this film, there is no way that park has insurance. None whatsoever. I mean, apart from letting tiny children ride on dinosaur backs, even if they are, you know, leaf eaters, they could fall on a child and crush it because they're sturdy little things. So that's not going to happen. The gyroscope that you can self-direct, gyrosphere, not going to happen.
And go into restricted areas.
Yeah, that seemed.
and the canoeing along a beautiful river with enormous dinosaurs nearby. Now, they talk about these invisible fences, and presumably that's some kind of implant, which means the dinosaurs keep a certain distance from things. Mm-hmm. But unless it's in every part of those bodies, then, you know, if it's in there, like the base of the neck of an Apatosaurus or something, they could swipe something with their tail, because they're so close, you can see it in the screen. They could swipe somebody with their tail without even being aware of it.
That crossed my mind too. You almost don't need the Indominus Rex, because people are going to die anyway.
People are going to die anyway. This park never,
I like the way they kind of acknowledge that, though. Doesn't Mesrani basically go, yeah, someone's going to die at some point.
Hooray!
Yeah, it's inevitable. Something's going to get loose.
It's
laissez-faire.
But also, here was the question I was actually going to ask. So what we see is there's a big hole, there's a big gate open in the fence, and that's how they get out in the gyrosphere. Yes. And the implication I took was that the Indominus had already broken through that fence. But the herbivores inside are not dead.
Mm. No, I think, isn't it lying in wait? It's resting.
So,
resting.
It opened the fence and then went back to the other side of the fence. Didn't go through, just opened the fence.
Well, my feeling is it crashed through the fence from the other side.
No, because it was in the restricted area to begin with.
Okay.
So if the fence is open to the herbivore,
all right. Well, maybe another dinosaur crashed through it in panic to get away from the Indominus Rex.
But then it would have had to be in that paddock, not killing herbivores already.
Maybe it killed some herbivores, and the
we did see later that it has killed a bunch of herbivores.
Yeah, but not in the paddock they were, because they were surrounded by herbivores who seemed quite calm.
Maybe they were in a different bit. I don't know. Yeah, we need to lock down maps charts of the island.
Was there a moment in the middle of the film where you were just waiting for someone to say, "It's killing for sport"?
Yes.
You're just waiting for that line, and sure enough. And then sure, he killed all of those, slaughtered the whole field of what sort of dinosaurs were those, bro?
Apatosaurus.
And none of the other ones ran away at all. They're all like within 50 yards of each other. So they must have been just standing there going, okay, my turn next.
Is she killing for sport, though? Or is she killing because she's freaked out and doesn't know what's going on and is just killing everything? I don't know. Is there a sense that she's having fun?
I got the feeling she was a rabid dog that needed to be put down. I think, you know, she'd gone loco, big time loco. Which is why all the dinosaurs teamed up at the end to take her down, because they realized that this was a threat. And so they needed to form the Dinosaur Avengers and stop it.
Was that the time you got locked in the meeting room in our old office for like several hours? We had to
and I clawed through the walls, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah. Took on half a Grazia.
Yeah.
That was a bad day.
I've got a quick question. Okay, in terms of how smart the Indominus is, does the Indominus Rex deliberately lead the helicopter to the aviary? Does it plan out that thing? Because it the helicopter is following it. And it goes into the aviary.
It would have
And it looks up at the helicopter at one point, and I thought, it is deliberately planning out all of this.
How could it?
We've established this, read the script, but it hasn't seen the schematics of the park, and it can't understand there's an aviary.
Somewhere.
It was just running blindly, I think.
It can't understand that the helicopter is capable of crashing through the aviary and releasing all those things, and that would then...
Besides, it crashes through the aviary.
It's
the first one to crash through the aviary.
Jesus.
And, cool dinosaurs always walk away from explosions. I mean, I think we've
there's an argument
that
it goes into the aviary, talks to the birds, and tells them to fly up to the helicopter.
This is as insane as the fan theory I saw today, which was that the young kid who Alan Grant nearly guts with a raptor claw in the first movie.
Who we talked to a couple of years ago,
Is Owen Grady.
The actor himself has said that isn't the case.
Yes, he has.
I like your thought, though. That he's Kaiser Sosaurus.
Well, I'd like to.
He's got everything nailed down. But if that is true, then why was he so close to the Mosasaurus pool at the end? He should have steered well clear of that as a battle zone.
Well, because it got kind of pushed by the other two dinosaurs. So one weakness in its entire plan. I'd like to see a subtitled version of this film where somebody has subtitled all the dinosaur interactions, like the Anchorman scene.
The Onion critic has actually done that.
Ooh.
If you look at the Onion film critic review of Jurassic World, he has actually subtitled the dinosaurs because he felt it was a major failing in all of these
There
films.
Are several extended conversations between dinosaurs in this film.
So there you go.
I love the end of the film. I mean, I have some issues with it, but I love the fact that at the end of the movie, having dispatched successfully the Indominus Rex, that the T-Rex and the Raptor then have a conversation with each other, which essentially translates as, well, little buddy, my job here is done.
And it I'm was going, Baxter yeah. in the bear, wasn't it?
Wasn't it Baxter turned up and talked everyone down off the ledge?
And the Raptor going, normally you would be trying to eat me, but I think we'd make a pretty good team, and let's team up and fight dinosaur crime. Why not? It's just kind of like, all right, okay, that's a sequel I'd like to see. I don't care about InGen's nefarious plans and what they're going to do with Dr. Wu's eggs. That sounds wrong. But I want to see the T-Rex and the Raptor solving dinosaur crime.
Kind of Sharky and George, but out of the sea.
Absolutely.
Then.
Prehistoric CSI.
Yeah.
I loved the, my favorite stretch of this movie is the third act. From when it turns to night very quickly.
Mm-hmm. How long is this day as well? It's a really long day.
The cut from day to night was a little bit, I wonder if there was some stuff lost there. Because it suddenly is night.
It's the tropics.
Anyway, that's
a very small quibble.
But I loved all the stuff from when they unleashed the raptors. I know it's daft, and I know the T-Rex thing is ridiculous, but just that whole stuff just doesn't let up. And it's so much fun.
Second time around, I had fewer problems with that. The dinosaurs working together is still a little bit something. But, you know, someone said it feels a bit like fan fiction. It's like, oh, we haven't had a T-Rex yet. Oh, what would you do? I know the T-Rex comes in and saves the day at the end, despite the fact he's clearly smaller than the Indominus. She, I guess. Are they still all female?
Uh-huh. Yep.
In this part?
It's the same T-Rex from the original.
Yeah, same T-Rex.
No way.
Yes.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, he's confirmed this. That it's you see the scars on the side of the face from the original raptor battle. Oh, they live a while. I mean, it's only been 20 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So that is the original Rexy.
Wow.
So he talked on the podcast, on the interview, actually, about how he saw the T-Rex as being sort of Burt Lancaster, an old gunslinger coming out for one final battle. Kind of thing.
That's amazing.
Forgiven.
That's amazing.
The whole raptor thing where they sort of, you know, go bad and then kind of come good again.
Mm.
It is part of this obsession, this modern obsession with making every bad guy a good guy. If you get enough sequels, at some point your bad guy will be a good guy. Terminator, you know, Darth Vader, even Hannibal Lecter in the prequel kind of sort of. You know, everybody gets to be a good guy at some point. It's bizarre.
But what I liked about this film was that it didn't neuter the raptors.
Yeah.
I mean, because I think we all saw that shot of them riding alongside Owen Grady. And just a reminder again, that's the character's name. the real name. Owen Grady. And they're riding alongside the bike. And I think everyone thought, oh, God, they're going to be teaming up and they're going to be high-fiving and doing kicks and stuff. And right from the off, that first scene is like, oh no, they'll gut you in a second if they can. And I really, really like that. And I like the fact that they turned, and I like the fact that they munched on a whole bunch of people. And they were just, at the end, they were kind of killing for sport as well. Mm. They were just butchering people and not remotely stopping for a snack.
Well, that moment I loved, the moment where they turn on all the humans. You kind of knew it was going to come, but it was really well handled. Really smart twist with the raptor DNA.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So presumably cuttlefish, if the Indominus Rex comes across some cuttlefish, he will be able to turn them to his evil bidding. And that could be the next film.
Oh, well, we never see a body. He's in the water right now with the mosasaur. Who knows? He could be swimming.
There could be a legion of cuttlefish even now. Cuttlefish World coming 2018. I'm quite annoyed. I'm really hoping that there is one more movie this summer that has a cuttlefish reference in it, because there have been two so far. Age of Ultron and now this.
Was there not one in SpongeBob?
Maybe
SpongeBob could team up with the Indominus and his cuttlefish. That would be
interesting. I'm with Nick in this one. I thought there were some terrific sequences in this film, and I thought the whole raptor chase, the idea of this, the doors closing as in a fan as they're trying to get away, and they're trying desperately to close the doors, and the raptors are closing in.
Yeah,
I really liked that. I thought there were some really, really nice ideas. The Indominus Rex appearing behind them in the gyrosphere in that
that
paddock.
Was great. That was
how many dinosaurs
shot.
Are four dinosaurs? No, there's five dinosaurs. What? It's like, and you can slowly see it emerging from behind them. I thought there was some great
and the breakout there. the escape sequence with the Indominus getting out, which happens really nice and early on in the film. I like that it's kind of loose and running around while all the other stuff is going on. But yeah, with the two most expendable looking actors, along with Chris Pratt, I was just chortling to myself in the cinema when I saw those two guys. Because by the way, Mexican Wolverine from 22 Jump Street.
Oh, really?
He's the other guy. Hey. Yeah. So you spoke to paddock, overweight paddock
Is
worker.
He?
Yeah, that's Mexican
that's
Wolverine.
That's Mexican Wolverine?
Yep.
Are you sure?
I'm 100% sure.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
So if you go on, I was looking down the IMDb cast list for Jurassic World.
Yeah.
Some amazing character names. The Mexican Wolverine guy, that is his IMDb photo. It's him as Mexican Wolverine
in
Elm Street. Yeah, it's definitely him.
Okay.
I had one sort of caveat to that, and I think these are really, really good. It does slightly lack the Spielbergian magic of the first film, the specific grace notes. And when I look back at the film, I know I enjoyed the ride, but I'm finding it hard to catch on to particular moments, like the water glass, for instance, in the first film, or the rats in the kitchen, you know, the T-Rex chase, and the little moments like, you know, objects may... Is it
a couple of nods to that, though?
Yeah.
There are little nods to it, don't get me wrong, but I just think, you know, with the chase sequence where they're trying to get away in the truck and the raps are coming after them, there just wasn't that thing that elevated it to the next level. Wasn't that clever, clever idea.
I agree, and I think what you're really missing also is I think the characters aren't even close to the first one. There's nothing in Owen Grady or Claire that is close to the core characters in the first film. I mean, my favorite moment, if I'm honest, in the first Jurassic Park is Alan Grant shaking and having to have a sit down when he first sees dinosaurs, when he first sees live dinosaurs, because that just sums up an entire, you know, an entire life, an entire career up to this point.
Yeah.
And suddenly just like, whoa. And obviously you can't quite have that again because that's, you know, the very first live dinosaurs. I get that that particular moment isn't going to be repeated, but you need something that has that impact and has that power. And these characters are, at best, archetypes for the most part. I think in some of the supporting characters, you get a little bit more to it. I think
Larry's
Jake Johnson,
fun.
Yeah, yeah, Larry is great. But I didn't care, ultimately, about Owen and Claire. I didn't get any sense of real chemistry between them beyond the fact that they're both super, super hot. And in Owen's case, super, super, super hot.
Well, can I just chip in and say Bryce Dallas Howard is super, super hot in this as well?
Yeah, okay. So they're both super,
fairness.
Super
We've
hot.
All agreed, in the interest of fairness.
I'm not sure how I felt about the kiss.
That was weird.
Bit off. Maybe it's the fact that all these people are still getting like killed around them, and that there's still all these dinosaurs loose. And
I don't know.
Then they have a nice kiss.
We won't know how you react until you've had.
I know, but
flabby
I just
thing.
Mean the moment in the movie with the music going. Hey, look, I don't know. It just seemed a bit like just coming just after a moment where, you know, even the little baby Triceratops almost got.
That would have been awful.
It's quite a dark scene. A lot of people die off screen in that scene. They do.
I didn't buy it. I didn't get the sense of banter between them. I didn't like either of them that much.
I think,
and I know you don't have to, but
he's likable because he's Chris Pratt.
Mm.
But it kind of felt again that he was being held back a little bit. There were loads of scenes that I saw. I was watching, and I thought Star-Lord would have crypt at this point. I know he's not the real person, but
Chris Pratt
in Parks and Rec would have quipped at this point. Burt Macklin, FBI, would quip at this point, and I just feel that it needed just a little bit more of that, so he wasn't just the generic, conventional tough guy who doesn't change.
Doesn't change.
Although he does become the mother hen at the end, which I thought was a nice little touch.
Now that is a Vic Hoskins metaphor. that's from the Vic Hoskins Big Book of Hen Metaphors. Do you know who almost, according to IMDb, played Owen Grady?
Jason Statham.
Jason. Freaking
Statham. Well, that explains a lot, actually.
You can see why they didn't cast him, because that wouldn't have been a fair fight for the Indominus Rex.
He was punched in the face. Yeah.
I think this would have been a much fresher feeling film if they had swapped those two characters around.
Yeah.
If he had been the... And I wouldn't even swap the casting, necessarily.
Yep.
If you had had Chris Pratt as the uptight executive, that immediately would have been more interesting than her being the uptight executive. I mean, and I'll be honest, like, some of the stuff I've seen about this. Trevorrow said that his writing partner did the, and I quote, women and children, that he has no feel for writing women and children. That's a little bit of a worry because, quite frankly, they're people. You just write people and you'll be okay. But also, like he said, that they were kind of going for it and it happened one night, sort of a vibe between the two of them. And first of all, she's way more uptight than it happened one night. And that was 81 years ago. And we should have come on a bit since. And I feel like we should have got a different model
but
to go from.
I liked that, you know, there were characters who changed and grew during the course of the movie. And I you know, the two kids, the two boys, Ty Simpkins and Nick Robinson, were, I think, were examples of that. Nick Robinson's character, who starts out as some sort of weird sociopath, staring at girls, just randomly staring at girls.
Every scene he's staring.
As if he'll somehow,
I think he's a teenage boy there.
He's a teenage boy, absolutely. But as if he'll somehow Darren Brown them into bed, or I don't know. But I really liked the little introduction. I thought it was quite subtle of the divorce plot line, and I thought Ty Simpkins' moment where he breaks down on the monorail.
He was great.
I thought he was really, really good. And he brings out a humanity in his brother. And I liked that the Raptors changed as well. I think, you know, I said in my review that, you know, this is the first movie to have character arcs for dinosaurs, and someone went, oh, I'd like to see that. Well, you have. So, you know, but I liked the way that Claire changed. I know there are problems, and I know that there are problems with the dialogue. And
I don't think she changed.
I think she did change. I think she changed a lot.
I mean, her outfit changed.
I think, no, she's much more warm and much more human by the end of the film.
It's quite broad, but
there's the moment where she cries when she sees that she starts thinking of the dinosaurs in terms of animals rather than and I think she, and the same with the children, I presume, but yeah.
I think she does. I think she has an awakening. I don't think she's necessarily a bad person at the beginning of the movie.
No,
I think she's just someone who's lost a bit of touch. Yeah, absolutely. But I've seen some people go, she's bad and even, you know, cold and corporate, and
yeah, she's
and
just busy. I think she starts off the film as a, you know, very capable person, ends it as a very capable person. I also think there's a little bit of an echo of San Andreas in that you've got people kind of leaving their post, frankly, at the moment of greatest crisis. I feel like both Claire and Owen possibly should have been somewhere slightly more central than chasing around after two teenagers out of touch with most of the rest of the park when a giant, brand new, untried, ununderstood dinosaur, that's a horrible word, I apologise, is on the loose.
Terrible phone signals on this island as well. They need to get Verizon in, frankly, because there's several moments in the film where they're like...
That's literally the next question from Evelyn Lang via email. He says, what on earth was going on with the story convenient communication blackouts? I assumed at first it was going to be the bad InGen lot, but then other calls went through. Yes, the calls just seemed to go through, and then, you know, this is one of those things. You didn't have this back in the original Jurassic Park, but now everyone can talk to everyone at any moment. Like, for example, when the Indominus Rex is about to attack Owen and Paddock supervisor and the other guy, and suddenly he's like, Get out of there!
Chris, that was the Indominus Rex. It has a special device which it uses to...
cloaking.
It's 24.
It's taken from certain deep-sea jellyfish.
Here's a question from Rob Johnson, who says, hi guys, I have a question about Vincent D'Onofrio's character's death, which you witnessed on set.
I did, I witnessed it.
You wrote around it very elegantly in your Jurassic World cover feature. Didn't give away who it was. Because if you'd given away who was in that room, then people would have been able to guess.
I couldn't mention that he was even there because people would have figured it out. But I was there watching while he forgot his lines many, many, many times. But what a great actor.
Got there in the end. All right, so just before he gets killed by the raptor, I could have sworn he said, woo, you don't have to do this. Am I mistaken? Or did he say blue? Does this mean that Wu sent the raptor to kill him so he could take the embryos for himself? And if so, what kind of power does he have over the raptors? Or am I completely barking up the wrong tree here? I think the
entire idea about that character is that he knows nothing about dinosaurs. He sees them as weapons. He doesn't know anything. He actually says boy, down boy, or something like that to Blue at that point, not realizing it's she's a girl. I think
it was Blue, not Wu, definitely.
Yeah.
But Wu is an interesting character, obviously, and the idea is that this technology, I guess, is getting out. Although I would have thought if this has been around for 22 years that other people would be on it as well by this point.
Can you patent the technology, I guess?
You can this is a growing source of concern that people are patenting DNA. But if you were extracting your own DNA and doing it independently from Amber...
Yeah. Well, of course, Jurassic Park is driven. The plot of Jurassic Park is driven by a rival company trying to get the embryos and trying to get their own technology up and running. So, what happened to that company, Nick? Do you even know which company that is that Dodgson works for? The bastard.
Oh, Biosyn.
Biosyn. Yeah. I mean, what's happened to them? Woo. You know, is Wu a double agent? Did you like the twist that Wu turns out to be a baddin? He comes back and it's his second film this summer to reference mad scientists and mad science.
I'll tell you what I like about Wu. Wu is a man who color coordinates his beverage to amber. So he drinks jasmine tea, which is the same color as the lump of amber he's got. There we go. I enjoyed that detail.
There you go. There you go.
Maybe the only person who did. Yeah, he's clearly going to be back, isn't he? Because he is kind of instrumental in things going wrong, and he's clearly off plotting his next move. So we're going to see Woo again, I think.
Good. And we have both Larry and Barry have survived, right?
Yes. Barry definitely survived. Yeah, I wanted more of Omar Sy's Barry, and I wanted more of Brian T's Hamada, who is the Japanese leader of the ACU, the Asset Containment Unit. And when I saw his little bits in the trailers, I was really hoping he was going to have a lot more to do and be the kind of Muldoon figure on the park, but he got taken out, which is a shame, I think.
I agree with you completely on that, but I would have liked to have seen more of Irfan Khan as Simon Masrani, who's the John Hammond figure for the movie. And I really liked him. He had a warmth and a benevolence that I thought really, really came across. And
he was cool.
He was cool. That's
why I was saying he's kind of a cross between Hammond and almost Malcolm.
Yeah.
And Malcolm.
He was. Yeah. I really liked him. I think he could have done more. But I have to say, one of my favorite shots in the film is his final close-up. As he's about to crash into the Avery, and he realizes that all the money in the world ain't going to save you from hubris. And, you know, Hammond is a hubristic character. And I think Masrani is as well, even though he's very cool and calm and, you know, hey, I'm more interested in my park and are the people enjoying it? And I'm all about the vibes. At the end of the day, it's his hubris. I can fly a helicopter. I can take the dinosaur down. Of course I can. That is his downfall. But it's a shame. I really
He's a likable character.
Mm. Yeah, he really is. Mm. Which is interesting because they could easily have gone the other way, the corporate moustache twirler. Whoa, ha, ha, I don't care about human beings. But I thought it was nice they went in a different direction. We don't have a lot of time left, but the film clearly sets up, especially with the Woo stuff and the InGen stuff, it clearly sets up a different direction. There's no way they can do another theme park. This thing ain't going to open again. Someone even says that in the movie. So where do you think Jurassic Park 5? We had a reader question hoping that it could be all about Edmund, but...
yeah, I wrote that.
But where do you want it to go? And do you want Bryce Dallas Howard to finally take over high heels?
Oh, a word on high heels. You can sprint in high heels.
Okay.
It's easier to sprint in them than to walk in them, really, because... because you should be landing on your forefront foot when you're sprinting anyway, so you don't need to put your heels down.
Okay. Should she not have swapped for a pair of trainers, or should she have come barefoot?
I think either would be preferable personally, but then I wouldn't be caught dead in those heels in the jungle anyway. it was a bizarre little character choice, but, you know, hey, well done her for running in it and keeping them on.
And outrunning a T-Rex in them.
Outrunning a T-Rex in them, yeah, that was impressive. I don't know if we'll see her again. I don't see what her role would be if it doesn't involve a park, if she isn't overseeing the park. So presumably it's going to have to be beasties getting loose somewhere.
Well, Owen could be involved. I mean,
Owen
if they go in a military direction, then I think that he could be back.
Well, Trevorrow said in our Trader breakdown, didn't he, that he saw... no, actually, he didn't. He spoke to Empire, Ollie Richardson Empire, about a year ago. First time he spoke about the movie, and he said that he saw Owen and Barry as characters that could go forward into a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's said he's not directing the next movie. It's unlikely he'll direct the next movie, so maybe those plans will also fall by the wayside. Also, Chris Pratt's dance card's filling up pretty damn quickly. But this film's going to be huge.
Yeah.
It's going to be huge. It's going to make a billion, isn't it? So there will be a sequel.
He was rather implying, Trevorrow, that what would happen if the dinosaur thing went open source and you can clone dinosaurs in other countries and other people get hold of the technology so that it might spread to another environment and a more irresponsible power, I guess, that hasn't learned from these mistakes.
Mm.
So I wouldn't rule out something that's... I think the thing is it does need to be in a contained locale. Mm. Otherwise, it becomes like a zombie dinosaur apocalypse and I don't think anyone wants to see that particularly. And it's not really practical. So, yeah, maybe it's just somewhere outside the US.
As long as we see parachuting dinosaurs at some point. Come on. I think we're going to see the next movie having a more warfare sort of slanted bent, I think. Mm. They can't do a theme park. So, yeah, we'll see. I'd quite like to see a spin-off about the bouncer in the control room who had a terrible day. He was trying to stop people coming in the control room. Everyone burst past him. He was having a shocker. So I'd like to see a smaller independent movie about him and his next job. And I wish him the best.
Entry not guaranteed. I would like to see that double act, double the cop, the dinosaurs.
The T-Rex.
Yeah, the dinosaurs teaming up and doing some crime solving, dino crime solving, in a with a time machine, going back to dinosaurs from this period going back to the actual Jurassic period, they're not from.
Like Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
With dinosaurs.
In a phone box.
Yeah.
In a giant phone box.
Well, they kill themselves. So it's like a dinosaur back to the future.
Wait, but maybe they'd be better than the dinosaurs in those days. Because there is that line here about we're not really making dinosaurs. These are very different looking beasts.
Yeah, it'd be a,
so maybe they're
culture
better.
Shock movie.
Yeah. Oh my maybe God. They
Blue
would
and
take
Rex's
over
Bogus Journey.
Yes.
The actual Jurassic period. Which some of them aren't even
the
from.
The Blugus Journey.
Blue and Rex's Bogus Journey.
My $12 is down.
That's amazing.
I don't know why I'm paying in dollars, but I'll pay any currency to see that film.
That it would probably cost $12 as well, in fairness. That's an astonishing idea, and I think that's a good note on which to end. That is it for our Jurassic World spoiler special. Thank you so much for listening. I think our next spoiler special is going to be either Terminator Genisys.
Genisys.
Terminator Genisys, or it's going to be Marvel's Ant-Man. So keep them peeled for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. Listen for the regular podcast, of course, if you don't already, every Friday. It's all a lot of fun.
And Edinburgh.
Yes, and if you're listening to this before June 21st and you happen to be around Edinburgh or Scotland and you're not a genetically modified dinosaur, because we don't want any of them, we're inclusive, but
not
to the point of stupidity. We're doing a live podcast at the Edinburgh Film Festival Sunday, June 21st, 11:30. Tickets are on sale via the Edinburgh Film Festival website. Just £5 a pop. We're going to have some special star guests. We're going to have spot prizes and four of us talking like idiots. And if you like that sort of thing, then come along to that, because it's going to be a lot of fun. Right. Until the next time you hear our voices, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Stay safe.
It's goodbye from Edmund.
Goodbye.
Yeah, it's the same voice.
It's very different.
I can see why you might have been cut out of the movie in Paris. And it's goodbye from me. See you next time. Bye.